happens at the end of the first day of a retreat, or in fact at the end of any day of a retreat, and look around and I think, wow, they're still here. And I'm impressed, because it can be hard work to look at our lives in the rather naked light of awareness. It was looking at our lives in a rather naked light. Naked means having put aside a lot of our roles and responsibilities and duties and obligations and distractions. There's not much here in the desert. There's not much here in this place with which to distract ourselves. Sometimes we might think rather unfortunately. But actually, it's a great blessing to give ourselves to the simplicity and to the refinement that starts to happen. The refinement of mind that's possible in this kind of environment. And some of you have spoken today about feeling the process of slowing down, of settling into being here. And some of you have also spoken about some of the difficulties in being here. Some of the things that you find yourself faced with in taking up this practice. Today of the little list that the Buddha gave about the difficulties we encounter. Actually, the Buddha gave a lot of lists. It was the five things that act or disturb meditation practice. And this list is kind of interesting for several reasons. So I just want to begin by giving a list and looking at what's interesting about it. He said, what are the five things that hijack? He didn't use the word hijack. I don't know if hijacks existed then. But what are the five things that can hijack our meditation? Hijack means catch it and take it away. And first of all, he says, so in the list, the way it's translated into English, it's the rather formal, the normal translations are the rather formal language of trying to find words from Pali, which is the language the Buddha spoke. First one is sensual desire. Means wanting something nice. We have to look ourselves and see to what degree at any moment our meditation is hijacked by wanting something nice. We might look and see to what degree our life is hijacked by wanting something nice. Well, of course, there's no problem actually. It's natural and normal to prefer the pleasant to the unpleasant. The fact of towards something sweet, enjoyable, beautiful, no problem. It's the hijacking that's the problem. And how fixed we can get in our insistence. I spoke a little bit last night about this gap between where I want to be and where I am, and measuring our suffering across that gap. And we see that happen when our mind becomes consumed with how we want it to be. And it can be the various, the things we want, the people we want, or the person we want. It can be the state of mind, or the meditation experience that we want. How much we can buy into the power of that wanting, the fantasy of it, as if it could make me happy. And that's the belief. If I just this thing, everything would be okay. There's no evidence for it. We've never had the experience ever in the past of getting something and suddenly everything's okay. All we've had is some momentary relief or pleasure, and then very quickly wanting something else. If we look carefully, we can see how strong the belief is that that's true. I was in a hotel a while ago with a friend, and we put on the TV, and there was a documentary about young girls in America. Young girls means 15 or 16 or something. Having cosmetic surgery. And I was very struck by the story of this one girl who was convinced that she had a terrible nose, a very big nose, and that she was going to have plastic surgery. First thing I was struck by was her nose looked completely normal to me. Didn't look at all big, but she was convinced that it was a terrible nose. And she was going through on the computer different types of noses she could have. They put them, you get the screen of your face, and then they put on different noses, and you choose, oh yes, that was a very nice one. One thing that struck me was the strength of the belief. She said at one point, looking at the camera, she said, "People think I'm vain." You understand vain? Vain means loving yourself, loving how you look or something. Or she said, but it's not that. She said, I just want to be happy. And I could very much relate to the sentiment. You know, we all feel, I just want to be happy. But I thought, what's she going to do the morning after the operation when the bandages come off? Or whatever else it is. Or if it's nothing to do with the body, what about something else? Endless wheel that we go round and round on, like a hamster. You know what hamsters in here? I think they're from the desert, hamsters, no? No? I don't know. But they run on those wheels. And if you look at them, they're convinced they're getting somewhere. That's what sensual desire, that's what the power of wanting is like. When we really believe, and we do again and again and again, we're convinced that it will make things okay. And as I say, nothing wrong with the movement towards what we enjoy and appreciate. But Dharma practice offers us an opportunity to really investigate what are our beliefs underneath it. The Buddha mentions, in English translated as ill will, basically means not liking or hating. And hate, excuse me, hatred, we like to ignore in spiritual circles. We like to focus on love and kindness and compassion. And even the word hatred feels like sometimes it doesn't have a place. We don't want to hear about it. We don't want to hear about it because it's strong, it's powerful, so powerful sometimes that we're terrified of it. We're terrified of what it would be to recognize that we can feel hatred, to let in hatred. This is one of the things that can hijack our meditation practice. And I think it's really important to actually look and see, where is this ill will, this not liking, this pushing away, which I'm using the rather strong language of hatred for. Even though we might not want to acknowledge it, there's plenty of opportunities for us to see that movement. Knees hurt. We can have the experience of hating. It doesn't have to be knees, can be shoulders, backs, ankles, necks, anything you like. But knees are my favourite. Knees form an enormous part of all the Dharma talks I give. Knees can be our guru, or backs or shoulders. So when I use knees, I use it interchangeably with everything else. The bare experience, heat, pressure, tension, whatever. And then what do we do with it? The great mystery of aliveness. The entire universe shrinks to the size of a knee. It fills up the consciousness. We forget about everything else. And we can get into a huge struggle with it. And we think it's all about the knee. If only I didn't have a knee. We think the knee is the problem. Actually, it's the hating. I hate it being like this. I can't stand it being like this. I can't stand the thought that it might carry on being like this for another 20 minutes or 40 minutes. Or whose stupid idea was that before breakfast to sit for a whole hour? Moment of pushing against. The whole relationship with time adds to the pressure. The idea of feeling like this for however long. And very often when something's difficult, what we do with it is we imagine how long it's going to last, which makes it much more difficult. So this bruising of the heart in some way, where we isolate some area of our experience and we close our heart to it, we turn away from it, try everything to make it be different, this pushing against. But we don't feel the actual movement of what's going on very often. We think it's all about the knee, and we think it's all about time. Huh? What's causing me the pain, and how long the pain's going to last? The Buddha doesn't say. One of the things that can hijack meditation is our knees. He says, one of the things that hijacks our practice is hatred. A warm invitation, but it's an invitation that's maybe hard to take warmly. To see when resistance, ill will, dislike, pushing, hatred all the space in our consciousness, all the space in our heart, And if that's the case, is it possible to name it and to feel it as such? To name it, to see honestly, this is, find the word that works for you. It doesn't have to be whatever the translation of hatred is, dislike, resistance, whatever. But to recognise that that's the predominant thing that's happening. And to feel that pushing, and feel what is it doing in my heart? What's it doing in consciousness? The pressure in the knee cannot disturb our life. But the power of hatred and resistance and refusal to let it in, that can completely wreck our well-being. I thought I was just going to run off this list quickly at the beginning of the talk. But, yes. Yes? What I'm saying is, hatred is one of the things, the Buddha says, that can hijack, can disturb our well-being, that can carry us off into a painful, contracted state. So, but often we don't see it, we don't say, oh, this is hatred. We say, we think it's all about the knee, in the example I'm giving, and all about time, until I can fix it. So the encouragement is to not worry so much about what we think is causing the hatred in any situation. Not think so much about how long the object, the knee, is going to last, or fantasizing about how to make that time shorter. It's another thing we do a lot. But to actually name and feel the movement of hating itself. And then instead of the hatred hijacking, it's a way of reclaiming what we're actually feeling. There's no way to meet life deeply without actually acknowledging what's there. Because life isn't anywhere else. Life doesn't start tomorrow. Always and only and completely here. But if the movement is all that pushing, that's our only way in. Yes. Okay, it's going a little bit away from what I wanted to talk about, but never mind. We can have ideals, and Dharma means truth, or the way things are in the Buddhist tradition. And Dharma also means teachings of the Buddha, or teachings of truth. Dharma teachings, like any other spiritual tradition, has some ideals, and names some beautiful qualities to which we can aspire. So one of those would be equanimity, upekkha in the Pali. The capacity to be steady, be open, be allowing to the movements of different flavours and qualities of life. So not to be destabilized by the pleasant into wanting and obsessing after it, and not to be destabilized by the unpleasant, destabilized by resisting and hating it. And there's a place, very much, I think, for reflecting on the beauty of these qualities and the aspiration towards these qualities. But can't manufacture equanimity. We can't manufacture peace. We can't manufacture love. We can't manufacture any beautiful spiritual quality that we might like to have. So how do we move from the difficult to being equanimous with it? We move to it through feeling what's there. So in this case, if the "oh no" is really strong, we try as much as possible to let ourselves feel that that's going on. And in doing that, we start to see that however horrible it is, however powerful it seems to be, it's never more powerful than that which has room for it. It's never more powerful than that which allows it. It's never more powerful than that which receives it, knows it, accommodates it, feels it. If we really see that, the fruits of that seeing have to be equanimity. The capacity to feel is always bigger than what there is to be felt. Does that make sense? So it's too much of a jump step to go from, "oh, I've got hatred, I don't want that. There's this thing called equanimity, I want that. So I've got to be equanimous with it." There's a middle step there that we're jumping. And the middle step is to feel what's there and let that give rise. Out of that feeling, naturally, these ideal qualities or spiritual qualities start to show themselves in our being, start to be the natural way in which we meet the vicissitudes, the comings and goings of the beautiful and of the difficult. A little part of your question which maybe is worth addressing, which is what to do, you say, when it's too much. And when it's too much, wisdom is not to fight with it. When it's really too much, wisdom is to move away from it, to actually find some way to give the heart some ease and relief. So it might be to remove ourselves when it's too much, just like when it's too much, the pain in the knee is too much. Sometimes we lose the capacity to just feel the tension. We're consumed by it. So wisdom says, okay, move. It's okay to move the posture. If we start to find ourselves, it's just too intense. There's a beauty and a value in being willing to just follow the schedule and sit in the sitting and walk in the walking and follow that. But there may be a time when the wisdom isn't just to follow the schedule. If we're making it into something, if it's tough guy meditation, right, I can sit for the sitting or walk for the walking, whatever happens. Actually, it might be wisdom to skip a sitting and look at the desert as a way to support the heart's ease. You have to listen and see, what is it that wants to come to the sitting? And what is it that wants to look at the desert? And if there's a sense of the value and the benefit that's there in following the schedule and slipping into that simplicity and just connecting with what's happening, whatever. And if there's gentleness in that, wonderful. If there's being tough in that, and the sense that it would be a failure in some way to miss a sitting and look at the desert, please miss the sitting. And if it feels like a failure, feel that. Like on the pressure cooker. Something to let the pressure out. So that we're taking care of what's there to be felt, but we're also taking care of the heart's capacity to feel. Tough guy doesn't do such a good job of feeling. He does a good job of managing.
Where are we?
Third one. Restlessness. Agitation. Just overtaken by a sense of not being able to settle. And again, the distortion of time is extraordinary. And that, I wonder if you ever had the experience in meditation of feeling restless and agitated and checking how much time. Oh my God! And you stick with it. So you stick with it for a few eons. And then check again, and 3 minutes have passed only. Restlessness easily leads to a lot of ideas about what's happening, what should be happening, a lot of criticism of what is happening. Because, and the ideas, where are they coming from? They're coming just out of the restlessness. If you're restless, then we start to have all kinds of ideas. The ideas are manufactured by the busyness in the mind. But what we come up with, because we don't like restlessness, is all kinds of ideas about how the staff could have done it better. How it's stupid, you know, the meditation's too long, the this is too this, that's not enough that. It's much easier. Actually, it's not. It's a terrible burden. But in the moment, it can feel easier to get righteous. Understand righteous? Mm-hmm. Thank you. Tzitzkalut. Because it seems to justify the righteousness, the restlessness. It's like this, because, and all the reasons, all the things that are wrong, all the things that is what I'm getting all puffed up about. I remember once when I was managing a retreat in Thailand, and some poor soul there was very restless. And in this way, it wasn't coming out in an angry or an indignant way, but it was coming out in a helpful way. He came to me one morning, he said, Martin, one of the taps is dripping. If you have a spanner, I can fix it. I said, okay, thank you. Very nice, but let it drip. Someone else will fix it. You can just do your practice. I noticed outside the meditation hall, somebody's shoes, the bottom is coming off. If you have some glue, I can fix it. Thank you. But... and he found plenty of things, this guy, all through the retreat, plenty of things that needed some attention, and very sweetly he was ready to fix it. I was just the manager. It wasn't my position to say, please fix your restlessness. It can feel easier to get into all the causes and conditions and reasons and things to do about. That's the nature of restlessness, no? There's lots to do. We recognize in our own life how easily we can get restless about there's lots to do. When we're busy with lots to do, we are often desperate for space. We say, oh, I just need some space. It's kind of mantra. I just need some space. And we maybe look forward to this retreat as a space. And then we get here, as soon as we have some space, what do? We think of ways to fill it up. All week, people who work all week, we're thinking of the weekend as space. As soon as we stop, right, what are we going to do? So we long for space until the moment we get it. And then we desperately try to think of ways to fill it up so that it's not space anymore. This is restlessness hijacking the mind. What's actually like when we let go of all the things there is to do about it and feel its quality in our being as a way of reclaiming it, as letting restlessness be our doorway into something else, something deeper. Can we feel its bubbling? When there's the production of ideas, of things to do, can we recognise, oh, lots of ideas are there, and not need to actually feed them or give substance to them or rush off into the, you know, filling up this list of things that need to be done. But feel, oh, this is the way restlessness produces thoughts. This is the way restlessness is in the body. It's something extraordinarily freeing to be able to feel restlessness without being restless. Does that make sense? Yeah. Be able to calmly abide with restlessness. In a way, as we mentioned with the hatred, that which feels restlessness isn't restless. Which allows agitation to be there isn't itself agitated. If you can't hold it yourself, the restlessness, open your eyes, hold it. Oh, so much space out there. More than enough space for a little bit of. How much disturbance is that in all of this space? Using this energy to use it for what? So what about it? What about using restlessness to move your body? Okay. So certainly sometimes that's what we do, no? We feel some restlessness and we feel, wow, the body wants to move somehow and move it, and it can feel kind of relieving and freeing. And why not? Circulation, yeah. And it can deal very effectively with restlessness for that time and in that moment. But if that's the only way we know how to deal with restlessness, then every time we feel it, we're going to have to do something. And why not? There's plenty of strategies in life that deal with these five disturbances in that moment by basically channeling them or distracting them from them or something. And all of them are fine because they deal with that one. It's like if you feel, oh, I really want chocolate cake, you go and get a piece of chocolate cake. Then you don't feel, oh, I really want chocolate cake anymore. No? That would be the first one, the sensual desire. You want something, well, just go and get it. And then you won't feel it anymore. Feel restless, just move. Then you won't feel it anymore. But the pattern is completely unaffected by those things, no? The arising of them in that moment is effectively dealt with. But the generality isn't dealt with at all. So we deal with this one, and then next one, and then deal with that one. So then our life becomes basically feeling some kind of hijack comes along, one of these five things, and then we do something to deal with it. It's a bit like plugging holes. You know, the water's coming up, like, oh, plug the hole, and plug that hole. We can be very busy. We are very busy. Our lives are spent trying to plug the holes of the various irritations and agitations of our lives. So Dharma practice is saying, let them burst out and really notice that they're bursting out. The metaphor might start to run out here, but never mind. But in essence, let them burst and see, why were we so desperate? Why were we so desperate trying to cap them? I will abandon the metaphor. But what we feel like something has to be done about desire. We feel it has to be followed. Something has to be done about this hatred. Has to be, the thing has to be gotten rid of. Something has to be done about restlessness. I've got to do something. Whether it's move our body or anything. And the same with the others. So these teachings are questioning, is that true? That something has to be done about it? Or is there something to be done about it? Actually, what is making the whole thing so difficult? Well, it's not adding anything extra. If here we are, in the context, and we're feeling restlessness. I mean, we can argue that it's doing something. But the doing something that really makes a difference, not just for now, but that actually transforms the way we experience these things, is the going into them, inside them, rather than doing something to cut them off or distract from them or stop them happening. There's a lovely name in English, sloth and torpor. No one, even English people don't understand what it means. They're very old words that nobody uses anymore, but they're very nice words. Sloth. Sloth means it's kind of it sounds like it, no? Sloth. And torpor. Torpor is like hello, nobody home. I think these translations were thought up a long time ago. That's why they sometimes the language is a bit stiff. Dullness, foggy mind, heavy mind, dull mind, mind that can't manage. It doesn't want to engage. It feels it can't engage. And the most common way that shows up is just by feeling that we're so sleepy. We may have had a good night's sleep, or we may not have, but we feel, oh, I'm so tired. I can't. And this nodding we recognize so well. I was just telling a little story about this. When I was living in India, in Dharamsala, it must have been 93, then they were building a Goenka center in Dharamsala. Probably some of you even sat a retreat in that center in Dharamsala. But they were just not really building it in 93, but making it ready for the first retreat there. They were in tents. And a friend of mine that was a very devoted Goenka student was helping a lot, working very hard, building the place up, making the tents ready, somewhere that could be a kitchen, somewhere that could be a Dharma hall. So they had the first retreat, and he, along with a few others that had been helping to build everything, they were serving on the course. You know, means helping, cooking, running everything. And at the end of the course, somebody who had sat was their first course. They were very happy. They said to the teacher, "Wow, I don't know how to thank you. I'm really happy with the practice, and it's great to learn meditation. But now I'd like to learn the advanced practice." And the teacher said, "Well, I'm sorry, you know, that's it. There isn't a different practice. You know, we've all been doing the same thing." And the teacher says, "No." The student says, "No. I've seen that some of the people are doing a different kind of practice, and I want to learn that one." And he said, "No, I don't know what you mean." He said, "Sure." He said, "Those ones that are helping out, the ones that are managing the course, they're meditating differently from us. Their way of practice is this." What's going on in meditation? You can be content in the knowledge that you're doing advanced practice. If someone listens to the recording, they'll wonder what we're talking about. No, they don't get this. On the recording. It's very real. And sometimes it is. Sometimes there's just an accumulated fatigue that we bring from our daily lives And when we have an environment like this and we stop, oh, that tiredness catches up. How can you tell if it's real tiredness? I would say irritation. If it's still there when you're going to walk, if it's still there at lunchtime, or someone nodding off over their lunch. If you have the sense that there's a real weariness there, a weariness in the bones, a weariness in the being, then please feel free to take rest. When the bell goes tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock, see where you're at. Where you're at, maybe you're already up and doing yoga since 5. I don't know because I'm not. I don't know. It may be that you're awake and ready to get up. It may be that you're not awake, or you're just waking up and you kind of don't feel like it. But there's a sense that really the reluctance is that just that. It's a reluctance. It's a not wanting. It's a not feeling like it. It's kind of cozy in bed. And what are we going to do when we get here? Just this stuff. In which case, please get up. Or it may be that you're genuinely exhausted. That there's that accumulated fatigue that's carried over is really there. In which case, please feel free to lie in bed for another 2 or 3 minutes. please feel free to rest. If you find that during the day you're really genuinely tired, then please feel free in one of the walking periods or in one of the sitting periods to skip the period and to take rest. If you find that when you take rest, actually, you're lying there. Sleep doesn't come. Feeling actually a bit restless. Can easily happen that sloth and torpor turn into restlessness. I'm getting to that bit. Sometimes sloth and torpor is just a kind of laziness of mind that we just kind of switch off. It's like breathing in, oh yeah, breathing out. You've done that before. Breathing in, and we just go off into some foggy state of mind. The breath just doesn't seem interesting enough. It can be helpful to bring forth a bit of energy. Bring forth means standing up or sitting with our hands above our head, or like one Zen monk is famous for doing, putting a piece of bamboo with a very sharp dagger on the top just here. He only nodded off once more. I was very brightly awake after that. Sometimes there's just that kind of, it's just that there's a dullness and laziness, and we can say, oh yes, I should try and stop, but it's kind of really gotten into the system. And standing up can be a very good support. Standing up, open the eyes, take a few deeper breaths, putting the arms up above the head, any of those. If it's especially bad, all of those. And also, it is a little more difficult to do sometimes, but in the same spirit of what I've been saying about some of the other hindrances, some of the other obstacles or hijacks, to notice that you're sleepy. Because the very nature of sleepiness is that there's this dull, foggy thing going on. But something knows. Something knows. And if we can look carefully, we can recognize that that which knows sleepiness isn't sleepy. That which knows sleepiness is never sleepy. It's wide awake. If it was sleepy, we wouldn't know. And it's possible to have the whole thing going on and for there to be a bright and luminous clarity. A clarity that knows very clearly the mind is dull. Mind can be dull, body can be sleepy, and the knowing of it can be bright. So, it's worth investigating to see if that's true, because it can give a very clear sense of the mysterious nature, the mysterious illuminating, you understand? Illuminating means that which makes light, that which makes clear, that which brightens. The brightening nature, the illuminating nature of awareness. So bright that it can illumine sleepiness. And if you don't find your way with that, it's fine. Then stand up, or breathe deeply, or those different suggestions.
Can you lay down?
Feel free to lay down any time during the day. It's wonderful to take rest, lie down, enjoy. Any time except when you've begun a sitting. Then, better to stand up. Lay down after the sitting, in the walking period. If you feel you're really tired, when the sitting ends, then lie down instead of walking. That's fine. But it's something very valuable in when there's the sleepiness there, in giving time to work with it. Either by standing up or by this way of investigating what I'm saying. Rather than just following the instinct of it. In the same way that with the restlessness, rather than jumping up and following the restlessness. In the same way with the sleepiness, instead of just lying down. To actually challenge that a little bit. And then if you're tired, by all means, lie down the rest of the time. Rest of the time. As much as you need to lie down to support rest is really okay. But at the end, after the bell rings. Okay. If you have the energy to open them, great. Sometimes it's not enough. halfway open and boom, close again. So we might need a bit more drastic action, like the arms or standing up. If opening the eyes is enough to bring some energy, that's fine. Great. If you feel brightness is there, you can leave them open or close them, as you like. Yes. So, in the way that I said at the beginning, sleepiness is sometimes just a kind of laziness or unwillingness to engage. With the breathing or something. It can be another kind of unwillingness to engage. You understand what I mean? Unwillingness to engage? Not wanting to be with. Because there's something we just don't want to see or experience or be with. And generally, the doing something to support being here, meaning standing up, or opening the eyes, or finding some way to stay steady with the presence, will start to reveal that, what that is. So the sleep can be a kind of a covering mechanism. And not just sleepiness in meditation, but sleep in our lives as a coping mechanism. Some people, when things get too much, go to bed. And stay there as long as possible. All through the morning sometimes. All through the afternoon sometimes. No, not at all tired. But just, it's this kind of thing, you know, as a child, and we want to just pull the cover over and we don't want to see. Yes.
You said
the brain, the mind can be bright and the body can be dull.
Actually, I said the body can be tired, feeling. The mind can also be dull, but the knowing can be bright.
And how to transfer the brightness?
Yeah. If the knowing's bright, nothing needs to be done. Body and mind will sort themselves out. Body and mind have their own kind of intelligence. And probably, if we recognize that the knowing of it is always there, the shock of seeing that is so amazing, body and mind will get very interested.
And if it doesn't work this way, the way you say it, yes.
Or do you mean if we see it, but they don't get interested?
We don't do anything to change it.
Not possible. If we recognize in the moment of seeing it, not as a general idea, but if we recognize in the moment that there's great dullness and sleepiness, that there's something that's bright and spacious, that's knowing that, oh, my God, we'll get interested in it, because it'll be a profound revelation, and body and mind wake up for profound revelations. Okay. Yes, we're really into sleepiness tonight. Yeah.
What is this awareness, not part of the mind?
Very good question.
Yes.
What is this awareness if it's not of the mind? No? I'm saying awareness can recognize the mind, know the mind, can know directly the qualities of the mind without being affected by them. Huh? That which knows restlessness, I say, isn't restless. So, like you're saying, we're pointing to the fact that awareness isn't really of the mind. It's not a quality of mind. It's that which recognizes all qualities of mind. But it's very hard. Hard means kind of impossible. To talk about what that is.
How do you know it?
Through knowing it directly. And like I was just saying to Ilya, if we see it directly, such will be the shock and surprise and revelation, we'll get very interested, and there will be no doubt. The hallmark of recognition, true recognition, is there's no doubt. Not a kind of arrogant no doubt, but of seeing something clearly. When we see something clearly and we know, that's what it is. Until we know, when we don't know what it is, we can have all kinds of strange views about it. And there's a famous example that the Buddha always gives of the man who stops on the road because he sees a snake that he's afraid of. He's lying there, coiled in the road. He doesn't know which way to go, around, to the side, backwards, forwards. And he stays there for a couple of hours, terrified, until the sun comes over the tree, and then he sees it's a piece of rope. In the moment of seeing it's a piece of rope, all the issues associated with thinking it was a snake, gone. Absolutely gone. And there's no doubt. Oh, it's a piece of rope. Oh, everything that I'd projected onto it as being problematic, actually, there's no problem in the rope. Like this. I can see you have doubts. No, I know. That's why I say go on.
I don't know.
Just go carefully, because this is very subtle stuff. I don't want, if you're not convinced, fantastic. I don't want to convince you. Because if I convinced you and you say, oh yeah, that sounds like a good idea, so what? All I'm interested in doing is suggesting the possibility so that we can look and see for ourselves. So just, if you pay attention now as I'm speaking, you can hear my voice, no? So there's hearing. But there's also the knowing of the hearing. And they're actually two different things. They go very much together, because knowing arises with what's known. So the recognition arises with the hearing. But there's the hearing and there's the recognition of it. And they're so close together that we don't distinguish. And we're so busy identifying, oh, I hear. So we put our sense of who we are with the hearing in that moment. And then we say, and then, ah, yes, we say, I understand, or I don't understand. And we put this sense of I with all the things that are going on in the mind and the body. Actually, the I doesn't really belong there. If I really belonged with this body, then would there be less I when I cut my nails? No? If I shave my head, does that mean I've lost some of me? No? If I really belonged in the body. If I really belonged in the mind, then I would have some control over it. Huh? Okay, stop thinking. Or the famous one, don't think about a pink elephant. What's the first thought that comes to mind? Try to not think of a pink elephant. Oh, my God. Well, in the meditation we say, please just breathe in and out and focus on that. But all manner of other things are happening. So we have some degree of control, but it's a bit poor degree. But if it doesn't make too much sense to you intellectually, it's fine to really try and feel your way. Ah, what's this? What feels right about this, and what feels wrong about this? Okay. But especially to just give attention to the fact that there's experience, hearing, seeing, speaking, smelling, touching, and mental experience, conceiving, remembering, imagining, thinking about, and there's some kind of background context which receives all the experience. And that receiver of experience is what we're interested in. What is the nature of this receiver of experience? In some ways, that's our inquiry in meditation. But because the receiver of arises so much with everything that's received, we use practices in meditation to start to see the difference. And seeing the difference means to start to find a way of being with the things that arise. And so I'm talking about some of those things that arise, particularly the distracting things that arise, which we're calling desire and hatred and etc. etc. So all of this practice is about understanding the way life moves in experience and understanding what it is that's experiencing it. And we have a whole bunch of ideas about what it is. It's me, for example, is the classic idea. But that's a kind of unexamined idea. So our practice is to examine our ideas and to inquire deeper and deeper into what is it actually that's the receiver, the container, the allower, the knower of all our experiences. And I don't want in any way to convince you of what that is, but I would like to encourage you to find out. Okay. Interestingly enough, the fifth one that the Buddha talks about is doubt. The fifth hijacker of our well-being is doubt. And in this kind of practice, doubt tends to go in one of three areas. It's in the teacher. Does this guy know what he's talking about? How does he eat his food? Does he look like he eats his food like someone who knows what they're talking about? Do the words make sense? Somebody else told me they went to a retreat with him and they liked it, but I'm not so sure. Somebody else said they went to a retreat with him and it was not so good. So maybe. So we can use all kinds of measuring to feed when the movement of doubt is running, or doubt in the teaching itself, comparing Dharma teachings with any kind of other teachings. What about the Tibetans? They see things a bit differently. Who's got it right? Who's right? This lot or that lot? Or another lot? And maybe one of the most crippling forms of doubt in ourselves. Doubt in the teacher, doubt in the teaching, doubt in the situation. Maybe it would be better if I'd gone to a retreat where I actually had more than 10 centimetres between my bed and the next bed. Maybe if I wasn't in a retreat that was kind of so all bunched up like that, it would be better. Maybe if I was in a meditation hall where I didn't hear the pots and pans from the kitchen. Maybe this is the wrong place, the wrong retreat for me. Maybe. But can we recognize the way doubt comes in to separate us? That's the nature of doubt, is it separates us from the thing we're doubting. Oneself. The sense that I can't do it. The sense that there's something innately wrong with me. Opens our eyes and looks around and sees everybody like Buddha. And myself in trouble. Body trouble, mind trouble, heart trouble, all kinds of trouble. I can't. What's wrong with me? That doubt, it's a very big subject actually. So we won't talk about too much this evening. But I'll definitely speak to more on one of the other evenings. But doubt tends to show itself in one of two ways, which we could call a phobic doubt. You understand? Phobic, you understand? Like to have a phobia, a kind of fearful doubt. That everything seems a confirmation of how wrong I am. And it can be anything. It can be the place I've chosen to sit. I chose the wrong place. The kind of clothes I bought to wear in the desert. The people thought to bring them that and I didn't. Lots of stupid details. And it can be just a deeper sense that there's something wrong. And that we find ourselves never good enough. And the movement constantly of comparing to others. Well, they seem to be okay in some way. And the belief that others are in some way okay and that I'm not. There's an incredibly painful movement of comparison that goes on, feeding a sense of doubt. Which, as I say, the nature of doubt is that it separates us out. And we feel the lesser than, smaller than, and the pressure of that. And the other way doubt is expressed more cunningly is, rather than phobic doubt, that fearful sense, is counterphobic. And counterphobic means against, like a combating mechanism. Where we feel better than. Her back isn't straight. I can just tell by looking at that one that he's away in the clouds somewhere. But I'm doing pretty good. May not be quite so crass as that. But, or it might be. But running underneath that, some terrible pressure to keep up the sense of being somehow special or better than. It's actually the same movement and it's the same pain as feeling less than. And it has just the same distancing qualities. feeling apart from or different than. And there's a sort of desperation that goes along with it, of trying to keep myself up there. The very feeling of being in some way better than or special goes right along with having to keep that going. That means we've got the whole time we're here to sit special, to walk special, to eat special, to keep reinforcing to ourselves and somehow in the silence transmit to others that we're okay. I'm okay. I'm doing well. And underneath that is always the nagging doubt that doesn't quite believe it's true. But that measurement of myself in terms of better than or worse than has an enormous hijacking quality on our well-being, on our capacity to rest with ourselves. Be simple, to be simply here. Not simply here. If we're comparing and judging and finding ourselves to be lacking or finding others to be lacking. It's a particular kind of misery. It's a particular kind of painful pinch on the heart. If you notice that, is it possible to name it as doubt and to care for it? Doubt, as I say, in the way it separates itself from others, it's like it puts itself in a corner and says, keep away. And what would we do? How would we feel for someone who puts themselves in the corner and pushes us all away? Naturally, we'd be deeply concerned for them. But it's sometimes difficult to find that kind of concern for ourselves. We're so used to it, we're so used to seeing through the doubting lens, through the measuring lens, through the comparing lens, through the judging lens, that we think it's normal. We don't find any care. The example I often give is how nice people seem to be who come on retreat. How generally kind and friendly people seem to be. At the end of a retreat, people are often sharing a lot of kindness and warmth with each other, hugging and appreciating one another. I've never heard somebody at the end of a retreat say to someone, you didn't seem to have a very good meditation practice. You didn't seem to walk very well. You didn't seem to sit very well. Your mind seemed all over the place. I don't know why you bothered coming. I'm glad to say I've never heard it, and yet how many times I've heard from people coming to speak with me that they're saying almost those exact words to themselves. What would we feel if we heard someone criticized in that kind of way? Even in the imagining it, we can feel our hearts go out to them. And yet the person we actually care most deeply about, the person the most close to us, that resides right here in our own hearts, we find it so difficult sometimes to really care for. It's just the movement of judging, of comparing, of doubting yourself. either through the lacking or through the kind of counterphobic pushing yourself up. Is it possible to take care of that? To care for the poor, doubted, frozen, panicked, small sense of ourselves that's hiding there. Manage or that you're not doing well in some way. What's that asking for? The attention that we give to ourselves, actually, whether it's breathing, whether it's body, whether it's walking, whether it's eating, in order for our attention to really deepen and to really reveal what's there in our being, that attention needs to care. It needs to be a gentle attention, a loving attention. It's love, a movement of doubt. It's love that allows what's actually there to have its life, to have its presence, be included in its arising in our being, in itself in our being, and in its fading away in our being. Love, unfortunately, is often in short supply, particularly for ourselves. The distancing, the panic. If we can see in the movement of doubt that way in which we're putting ourselves in the corner, separating ourselves from others, if we really see that, our natural response is to feel for that, for the doubter, to take him or her into our arms, as it were. And the very movement that seems so horrible that it should have no place, to actually include it is to heal the depression, the panic, being has as its very nature the capacity to include, to reveal, what should be there in our experience. It has room for it all, just like the desert has room for us all. It doesn't seem to mind which country we come from. It doesn't seem to mind whether we wear orange or red or blue. It doesn't seem to mind if we're this body shape or that body shape. It doesn't seem to mind how good or bad a meditator we are. It just blows a gentle wind as we walk through. The very nature of our own being has that same capacity to include. And when we start to shine the light of caring awareness on these movements, on this wanting, on this resisting, on this restlessness or dullness, or on the very movement of doubting and measuring ourselves, we start to feel into the space below these contractions. We start to intuit that which has room for them. We start to make possible a genuine freedom in life. And if our days here are as sincerely as possible in the service of that freedom, then they'll be for our very deepest welfare and benefit. And for the welfare and benefit of the lives of all those whom we have contact with. goes in all directions. There'll be just 5 minutes or so in which you may wish to carry on sitting quietly, or to stretch your legs, or pee if you need to. And then we'll ring the bell in 5 minutes for a short sitting together, or 20 minutes or so before bed. Thank you.